tropical heat wave.
Hey, Lori.
Hey, Linda.
Hey, we're the Lulus from Tuesday Traffic Jam. WMNF's tropical heat wave is coming to the Cuban Club in Ybor City May 4th. And we don't want you to miss this night. 16 bands, including the sensational Barnes Brothers, Eddie 9V, Ruthie Foster, The Record Company, and Say She She.
In the Cantina, you can see Christopher James Band, Selwyn Birchwood, The Dolly Rots, Sweeping Promises, and Tiger 54.
Stop by the theater for the hip-hop experience.
Dance in the ballroom with the Real Class, Black Valley Moon, Divine AF, Soul 4, North Star, and Wah! World Fusion. Go to tropicalheatwave.org for tickets or for further information, call 813-238-8001. See you at the heat wave.
Having a heat wave, a tropical, tropical heat wave.
Welcome to Tuesday Cafe. I'm Sean Canaan, and we are broadcasting from the studios of WMNF in Tampa. Yesterday was Earth Day. In April, we recognized WMNF's mission by focusing on the environment. Today, we're going to hear an episode of the show called Letters and Politics. It's hosted by Mitch Jezerich. If you like this show, you can hear it every weekday on our HD3 channel, The Source. It comes on at 6 o'clock in the afternoon. The Source is a 24-hour-a-day broadcast of news and public interest shows that you can listen to on the WMNF app, on an HD radio, or at WMNF.org. In this episode, Mitch interviews Elizabeth Colbert. She's the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, the Sixth Extinction. Here is today's Letters and Politics on WMNF's Tuesday Cafe.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters and Politics. On today's show,
the runaway greenhouse effect that Venus has, which is, you know, just Venus has an atmosphere that's, you know, very largely carbon dioxide, and it's fantastically hot. I can't remember how hot, you know, 800 degrees or something like that. I don't think that that scenario, people feel that that scenario is going to play out on planet Earth. But humans, you know, we're a pretty young species. We are, you know, roughly 300,000 years old. And we are pushing the climate envelope, you know, we're pushing the climate outside of the envelope that we evolved in. It's not really clear how humans would respond to even, you know, relatively minor temperature changes. And I think another key point, you know, the other thing that you set in motion besides potential ecological disaster is human disaster. And that has tremendous political repercussions that are not very happy.
A conversation on the climate with renowned environmental journalist Elizabeth Colbert. She won the Pulitzer Prize for her book, The Sixth Extinction. And her latest book is called H is for Hope, Climate Change from A to Z. Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today I'm very happy to welcome back to this radio program renowned environmental journalist Elizabeth Colbert. Elizabeth Colbert is with The New Yorker, and she won the Pulitzer Prize for her book, The Sixth Extinction. She's the author of many books, including her latest, which is called H is for Hope, Climate Change from A to Z. It's a collection of essays along with illustrations. Elizabeth Colbert, it is my good pleasure to welcome you back to this program. Thank you for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
I want to talk about your career as we begin here in covering the environment and how that coverage has changed and adjusted, and maybe even your view about the environment and even climate change. When did you begin covering the environment?
Well, the first piece I did that could sort of, in a broad way, be said to have been about climate change was all the way back in 2002, I guess. I went to the top of the Greenland ice sheet with some Danish scientists who were drilling a core all the way to the bottom of the ice sheet. So that's through 10,000 feet of ice. And that they were really looking at the climate of the past, but with a obvious interest in what that portended for the future.
Greenland, and you also write about Greenland in H is for Hope. Did you go back to Greenland? Have you been going back to Greenland?
I have been back to Greenland a couple of times. It's one of my favorite places in the world.
I remember being on a plane flying back from Europe, and usually it's at night when I'm flying, but this time it was right in the middle of the day, and everyone's shades on their windows were closed, and I sort of like opened mine up a little bit and looked out my window, and below was Greenland, and it was the most incredible thing. I wanted to yell at everyone in the plane, open up your shades. This is wild, no pun intended, but you know, it was just a bunch of snow and ice and these really interesting rocky, I don't know if they're mountains, so high formations. It really was one of the most incredible things I've ever seen. And this was just from looking out of my plane window.
Yeah, it's spectacularly beautiful. Very dark rock, sometimes protruding from the ice, but mostly just this fantastic ice sheet that we're in the process of melting away.
Was it like being on an ice sheet?
It's very cool, to forgive the pun. It's otherworldly. I think it's sort of as close as you can get to being on another planet and still being on planet Earth. If you're at the top of the ice sheet, there's really nothing but whiteness in all directions. And it's very still and very, well, I guess it can be quite windy actually, but very, very quiet, sort of this interesting silence. There's nothing much living on the ice sheet, obviously. So it's sort of sublime in a beautiful and also intimidating way. I mean, it's a hostile place. People do not live on the ice sheet except under, you know, almost, once again, almost like not quite like mounting a space expedition, but very carefully planned expeditions.
Is it dangerous?
It's actually a lot more dangerous to be toward the edge of the ice sheet. You get crevasses, and as the ice sheet changes, those are becoming, you know, that's becoming more and more dangerous. Guy I knew, quite a well-known glaciologist, Connie Steffen, who was a very, very experienced glaciologist, died just, I guess it was about 2 summers ago. And that was, I think, very sobering and scary for people who work on the ice. If you're actually up on the very top of the ice sheet, that is still pretty, you know, pretty stable. You don't want to get into any trouble there. You don't want anything to happen. You know, storms can come up, and you have to be very, very vigilant.
Seems quite logical. In a warming world, it would become a more unstable place, a more dangerous place.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You have to be super, super careful, because these crevasses, which are, you know, extremely dangerous, and you fall through one to your, you know, inevitable death, can be hidden by the latest layer of snow. So that is what's really dangerous.
Does it have an ecosystem, a biodiversity to it?
The ice sheet itself is pretty hostile to life. I'm sure there's a microbial ecosystem, you know, and that is a very interesting question. As once again, as it warms, I guess, is that changing? Is that changing the reflectivity of the ice sheet? All of those are interesting questions, but there's not very much animal life or plant life on the ice sheet. It's you know, it's like living on an ice cube, which most things really can't do. Sometimes polar bears do wander across the ice sheet, but they don't really want to be there. They really want to be out where they can, you know, be hunting for seals. They really want to be on the sea ice.
Are there, obviously people don't really live on the ice sheet, but do communities live near the ice sheet that somehow rely on it, and this presents a change for them, or even beyond people, even other species, even if you're not on the ice sheet itself?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the sort of, you know, poster animal for the dangers of global warming has become the polar bear, who needs sea ice. And the sea ice, which used to be in the Arctic, you know, very reliable. Now there are a lot of places where, you know, summer sea ice has disappeared, and that is really making life very difficult for these animals that need to hunt off the sea ice, or have their calve on the sea ice, you know, haul out onto the sea ice to have their babies. So that's a huge problem. That's also a huge problem in the Antarctic for penguins. who are having to travel farther and farther, you know, to find food. So there are a lot of huge ecosystem changes going underway in both the Arctic and the Antarctic. Now, no one lives on the Antarctic, in the Antarctic, but many people live in the Arctic, and many people live on Greenland, about 50 or 60,000 people on the edge of the ice sheet. And they are also seeing tremendous changes. You know, I'll just give you one example. They used to have a lot of, in this town on the west coast of Greenland, a lot of dogs, and they would dog sled in the winter. That's how you got around. That's how you got across this bay that froze over. Now the bay does not freeze over anymore. And they've literally, you know, euthanized a lot of the dogs, a lot of these sled dogs, because they were not useful anymore. And that was quite, you know, sort of controversial and very sad for many people.
So you have been going to Greenland occasionally for more than 20 years now. Is this sort of a base point for you in your thinking about climate change? Have you personally seen changes that have happened there?
Well, I don't want to claim, you know, to have the kind of deep knowledge that people who live there or who go back every year, there are definitely scientists who have been going back, you know, pretty much every year for many years. But you can, just as a sort of lay person, see signs of tremendous change. You know, for example, you know, as the ice melts, it does leave behind telltale signs, sort of like bathtub ring signs. And you can see that very clearly in some of these ice fjords. And when you talk to people who have spent their lives there, they talk very openly, obviously, about these huge changes they've seen in the course of, you know, the last 20 years or so.
Bathtub ring signs. That's a vivid description. I've never been to Greenland. I've only flown over it. But yeah, I know what a bathtub ring looks like.
Yeah. You can see where the ice was, how high it was, and then as it melts away, you know, the color of the rock is different, and so you can see it leaves behind very clear traces. And you know, I live in a part of the world in New England that was itself shaped by the retreat of enormous glaciers, Greenland-sized ice sheets, and you know, so you're seeing some of those processes, those same processes that shaped our landscape here in New England. You're seeing those play out in Greenland right now.
So you see this. I mean, you sort of recognize what you see in New England.
You certainly can. Once again, I don't want to, you know, claim some tremendous expertise, but if you're with someone who's showing you where to look, you can see what's formations that are forming that you could also find. Now, once again, in New England, a lot of them are, you know, now covered by trees or, you know, farms, but you could see very clear analogs if you sort of knew what you were looking for.
And so was it this first trip to Greenland in which you're like, is that what sparked your desire to continue covering it? And were they telling you, I think you said 2002, you'll forgive me if I get the year off a little bit, around 2002, were they talking about changes already happening then?
Well, that was an interesting part of the trip. The glaciologists I was with, a group of Danish glaciologists, they said they were not yet seeing changes on the top of the ice sheet at that point. But, and I remember this very vividly, more than 20 years later, one of them said to me, well, we know we're going to see them because the physics of climate change are impeccable. There's just no doubt that when you pour a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere, you're going to heat up the planet and you're going to obviously change the ice sheet. So I have watched that, you know, prediction, or if you want to say just analysis come true, and now you see tremendous changes at the top of the ice sheet. For example, to give you one change that people are seeing, you see rain. You can see rain all the way up to the top of the ice sheet at 10,000 feet in elevation, and that's huge. And that when you get that kind of rain, you know, precipitation, water that's above the freezing temperature, that just is bringing a lot of heat to the ice sheet and accelerating this melting process.
Yeah, perspective has definitely changed over the years. I think many of us, even if we believe the scientist, and I think many of us, we always talk about those who don't, but many have believed the scientist from the beginning. I did. But again, you just sort of believed them. You didn't see it. But I think everywhere, I live in a metropolitan area where people from all who were born and all around the world live. Anyone I talk to from any place around the world will tell you the weather is different than when they were young.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to willfully ignore it to say otherwise.
Yeah. And then how has your reporting on climate change then changed over the years? And is what, and of course things change as time change, facts change, things don't turn out exactly how we always think they're going to turn out, but how has your view as a journalist covering climate change changed over these years since you first started in Greenland?
Well, I think, you know, as everyone at the time in the early 2000s, you know, thought, well, one of the problems here is that people aren't actually seeing this problem in their everyday lives. And if we, you know, sort of alert them to what's going to happen and how what we're setting in motion, they will take action to try to prevent the worst impacts. And now, you know, 20 years later, we're seeing, you know, very grave impacts, but not by any stretch of the imagination, you know, what we're going to see. We're heading into really dangerous territory now. And yet we still don't see the kind of action to stave that off. So, you know, I've had to readjust my thinking about what it will take to wake people up to the scale of this problem.
One of the chapters in your book, and again, it's a collection of essays for each letter of the alphabet, A through Z, along with illustrations. One of the chapters is based on the letter U, which is about uncertainty of the future of climate change. Tell me about that uncertainty.
Well, we rely to project what's going to happen. We rely on climate models, these very, very complicated climate models that run, you know, on very sophisticated computers. But as any climate modeler will tell you, you know, the actual system is even more complicated, much more complicated than the models. And so the question is, and this has become extremely relevant, you know, just in recent months, as we've seen these really off the charts temperatures, and particularly off the charts sea temperatures, you know, are things happening in the climate, to the climate, that are not captured in these models? And, you know, any modeler will tell you there are a lot of processes, including, you know, a lot of these melt processes of the ice sheets, that are not well captured in the model. So there's a lot of uncertainty going forward. But, you know, while some in the sort of, you know, climate denial, what I'll call the climate denial world, would say, well, you know, we just don't know what's going to happen, we have a very good idea of what's going to happen. And the uncertainty tends to be on the bad side. It's not on the good side. You know, when you look at uncertainty, for example, in sea level rise, you know, there's virtually no, you know, uncertainty that we're going to get significant sea level rise. The only question is on the bad side, how much sea level rise are we going to get? And there are big uncertainties there.
We're listening to an episode of Letters and Politics. Mitch Jezerich is interviewing Elizabeth Colbert, the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, The Sixth Extinction. This is Tuesday Cafe. We're coming to you from the studios of WMNF in Tampa. Here's more of Letters and Politics.
When I was in college many, many, many years ago, I took a geology class, and I suspect this still holds true. The teacher, and I always remember this, told us, when you hear a weather forecast, never believe it like 4 or 5 days in advance, because it's just so complicated. No one can ever predict, you know, accurately predict the weather on that scale. And as somebody who follows the weather a lot, I get the sense that's still true. So never mind looking ahead of what's going to happen 10, 20, 30, 100, or even 200 years.
Well, that's an argument that's often made in the, once again, the climate, you know, denial community. But, you know, weather is what would be referred to as a chaotic system. It has very much dependent on what you feed into it in that initial, these very tiny changes can result in, you know, as they refer to it, there's a butterfly effect, in big changes out in the forecast several days from now. That is not the case with the climate. The climate of the Earth, you know, this huge system, is based on energy coming in from the sun and energy going out, being re-radiated by the Earth out to space. And, you know, I don't want to get too technical into the physics involved in that, but that is a pretty fundamental equation that, you know, people have understood since the 1850s. And that is the big determinant of the, you know, climate on planet Earth. And there are many, many subloops in that, which are also, you know, pretty well understood at this point. So I would say that our predictions of what the Earth's temperature will look like will be, you know, given a certain amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, those are pretty robust predictions, and they're probably better than what, you know, what that will be in 100 years than what the weather looks like 2 weeks from now, which, as you point out, is very still quite difficult to predict.
Yeah. And I certainly am not trying to make the denialist argument, just sort of the idea of how. But let me follow up on that, though, by asking, is it within the realm of possibilities that it's not as, when we say bad or good, it's always relative what we're talking about, but it's not as bad as maybe we suspect it could be?
Well, I think that that's extremely unlikely, unfortunately, because we are actually testing this system. One might have said that. One could have said that 20 years ago. Maybe there's this figure called climate sensitivity, and that is basically how much temperature change do you get out at the end when you put up a certain amount of CO2 into the atmosphere. And 20 years ago, you could have said, well, maybe it's at the low end. You know, maybe we'll get lucky here. Now, nowadays, especially as we see these in recent months, really rapid run up in temperatures. So you could have thought that, you know, we were going to get lucky. But as the actual data come in, I think that the odds of that, you know, have become vanishingly small, because we already are getting out a very large temperature increase for the amount of CO2, you know, that we put up there.
It seems like as time goes by, our predictions so far, since we've been talking about climate change, our predictions haven't really even equaled the magnitude of what we potentially will see. Is that your experience as somebody who covers this much more closely than I do? Is this your experience over the years, that the more we learn, the worse it's looking here in the future?
Yeah, I'm afraid that that's true. I mean, I think that we're seeing, and, you know, you will frequently read this, you know, in press accounts, and I read them just as, you know, religiously as other people, even though I write them too. You know, this is happening faster than we expected to. And there is pretty good, you know, once again, analytical evidence that a lot of these reports, climate change reports, a lot of them come from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. These are very conservative bodies, and these documents reflect a sort of consensus view, and they turn out to often be overtaken by events.
Well, what's the worst case scenario that experts see here? And I guess we talk about time frame, right? Are we talking about like in the next 50 years? Are we talking about in the next 100 years, 200 years?
Well, the worst case scenario is quite, you know, quite grim. You know, the worst case scenario, where we just keep blithely, you know, pumping CO2 into the atmosphere, and then we sort of lose control over a lot of these processes that have feedbacks that can take over. So, you know, to give one example, when you start warming up the Arctic in particular, you start getting methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas. You start getting the permafrost thawing and releasing methane. And, you know, then you can dump a lot of carbon into the atmosphere that you know, you didn't, as humans, you didn't, you know, it doesn't come from burning fossil fuels, but you've set up this feedback that feeds on itself. And the worst case scenario is once you start setting up these feedbacks, are pretty bad. They contain, you know, tremendous amounts of sea level rise. They can already have, you know, kind of horrific temperature increases that lead to, you know, terrible drought in some parts of the world, including, you know, the southwestern U.S. And potentially California, and tremendous flooding. You're seeing, you know, sort of the beginnings of that cycle of, you know, very dry periods and then, you know, tremendous rains. That is climate change related. And you see potential collapse of key ecosystems. I mean, the list goes on, and it's not a happy list.
Could it represent the elimination of life on the planet? I mean, could we become like Venus or Mars?
I think that you know, the runaway greenhouse effect that Venus has, which is, you know, just Venus has an atmosphere that's, you know, very largely carbon dioxide and it's fantastically hot. I can't remember how hot, you know, 800 degrees or something like that. I don't think that scenario, people feel that scenario is going to play out on planet Earth. But humans, you know, we're a pretty young species. We are, you know, roughly 300,000 years old. And we are pushing the climate envelope, you know, we're pushing the climate outside of the envelope that we evolved in. It's not really clear how humans would respond to even, you know, relatively minor temperature changes. And I think another key point, especially given the moment that we live in, where immigration is a huge political issue, you know, the other thing that you set in motion besides potential ecological disaster is human disaster. And that has tremendous political repercussions that are not very happy.
Yeah, I don't mean to be extreme here, or maybe I do mean to be extreme here, but even beyond just climate change, the results of climate change could cause huge upheavals, which potentially I could imagine leading in the future. We're all looking forward here, a potential nuclear war even, which then would have its own catastrophic. So it could be something that would compound even further catastrophes.
Yeah, I think that, you know, many, many reports by militaries, you know, around the world have looked at climate change as a, you know, risk multiplier. Everything becomes riskier in a world that's changing very fast. And that, you know, makes absolute sense, right? If you're in a water stressed part of the world and it becomes more water stressed and everyone has to get up and leave from parts of the world where there's simply no more water, you know, and this is very plausible and, you know, already happening in certain parts of the world. Well, obviously you have, you know, political problems ensue.
Yeah. I mean, just even recently, a major drought in Syria has been credited as being a major part of destabilization there, along with, you know, the U.S. invasion of Iraq and these other things, but
yes, it's often hard to disentangle all the political forces in any given political crisis. But I think climate change, you know, the idea that climate change will play more and more of a role, I think is pretty undeniable.
This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation with environmental journalist Elizabeth Colbert. Elizabeth Colbert is the author of many books. Her latest is called H is for Hope, Climate Change from A to Z. So far, my questions have been more like you would think that your book was titled D is for Despair, which is my fault.
Yeah.
On me.
Yeah.
This is on me.
We
this is on
really
me.
We talked about the hopeful parts of the book. Yeah.
Let me ask you about then the beginning of the book with A, someone I had never heard about, and I would like to ask you who this person is. It is, and I'm probably saying the name wrong, Svante Arrhenius.
Yeah, I think that's close to correct, but I'm not Swedish myself, so I should know the absolute correct pronunciation, but I think you're getting it pretty much right.
Who was Svante Arrhenius?
He was a chemist, basically, who lived in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and he won a Nobel Prize for a discovery that had nothing to do with climate change. But in the 1890s, he became interested in the question of what started and ended ice ages. And he had this theory that it might have been changes in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, because it was already well established at that point that carbon dioxide is what we would now call a greenhouse gas. It traps heat near the surface of the Earth. And so he performed these, you know, very laborious calculations in the days before computers or even calculators to try to figure that out. And one of the sort of he was not interested, not terribly interested in the future, but one of the things that he was much more interested in the past, but one of the things he did realize in the course of doing all this work was, well, we humans are, you know, pouring a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere by burning coal mostly at that point. And so that will change the climate. That will warm the earth. And so he is sort of credited as the first person to have built the very, very earliest sort of climate model, very what we would now consider very primitive. But one of the interesting things about his calculations is that when he looked into the future and said, what would happen if you were to double CO2 in the air, which is what we're in the process of doing, you know, what sort of temperature increase would you get out at the end? And the numbers he came up with are, you know, sort of almost uncannily close to the numbers that these fantastically much more complicated models today put out.
Was he raising the alarm of what this could mean?
No, he was not. He wrote about it, and he decided, he was a Swede, I should point out. It was pretty chilly. He decided it would actually be quite lovely to have a warmer world. He also thought it would take a tremendously long time. He thought, and this is an interesting part of the whole history of sort of the people coming to understand the impacts of burning fossil fuels. He thought that the vast majority of the CO2 we put up into the air would be absorbed by the oceans very quickly. And that does not turn out to be true. The oceans do absorb a lot of CO2, and over great stretches of time, they will absorb most of the CO2 we put up there, but they are not taking it up nearly as fast as we are putting it out there. So you have a lot of CO2 accumulating in the atmosphere, and he did not appreciate that. And that fact was not appreciated until really the middle of the 20th century.
We're listening to an episode of Letters and Politics. Mitch Jezrich is interviewing Elizabeth Colbert, the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, the Sixth Extinction. You're listening right now to Tuesday Cafe. We're coming to you from WMNF Tampa. Here's more of today's episode.
I have to be honest, in the early 2000s even, as late as the early 2000s, I lived on the East Coast. I was a political reporter. I'm a California boy. I also had that thought that it'd kind of be nicer, you know, and to have a little bit of a warmer world. I found the East Coast winters to be quite difficult to get through. You know, of course, you look back on that now, and you see how naive I was with thinking that.
Yeah. If you don't mind being underwater on the East Coast, then it's fine.
But yeah, did we have to go back and find Svante Arrhenius and what he had done with this calculation, because it became more significant later on, or what was what he was writing or talking about at his time significant, and people were paying attention to him? And if so, how did they respond to him?
Well, this gets a little complicated, but people were paying attention to him because he was a big shot in the world of science. But someone else came up with a theory that challenged what would happen if we put up more CO2 in the air, and that became this notion that you would saturate the atmosphere in certain wavelengths. Once again, I'm not going to go into the details there, but that was compelling to people for a while, until that was proved false, and Arrhenius's calculations once again were sort of dredged up, I suppose, and he has become sort of the, you know, father, grandfather of climate change, but did not think of himself that way.
Another essay in the book is based on the letter T, and this is about temperatures and experiments with the effects of extreme temperatures on the human body. Well, what do we know about, and of course, we were seeing heat, major heat events happening all over the world now. What do we know about heat in the human body?
Well, for that chapter of the book, I went to a lab in Texas where they're doing heat experiments. You know, how does the body deal with extreme temperatures, or what are now considered extreme temperatures, and had myself sort of locked into this, what looked like a walk-in fridge, but was actually very hot. And, you know, they were measuring my heart rate and all my bodily functions as my body tried to deal with this heat. And one of the things that extreme heat does is it really stresses your heart, because you're trying to pump blood out to the surface to dissipate the heat. And older people especially have a really hard time in the heat. And when you get one of these terrible heat waves, and, you know, a lot in, for example, there was a huge heat wave in Europe in the early 2000s. A lot of people didn't and probably still don't have air conditioning. And a lot of people just expired, died. You know, it was called the excess deaths because they just couldn't, the hearts couldn't keep up with trying to cool down the body. And once you can't cool down your body, all sorts of other problems ensue, you know, because our various cellular processes are not, you know, can't function at very high temperatures. So, you know, you can get some pretty, you know, this is heat stroke and all the things that follow from that.
Yeah, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. Few of us have air conditioning. Most of the time, we don't need it, except for a few days of the year. But however, we sort of had a reprieve these last couple of years. But the few years before that, we had these major fires. It was hot all the time. You had to keep your windows closed because of the smoke outside and the air quality. It was miserable. I mean, it was a miserable experience.
Yeah, I mean, fire is another huge impact we're now finding of climate change. And it's another one of those impacts that unfortunately has feedbacks associated with it, you know, because you burn up these forests. It's tremendous. You know, last summer, maybe you in California were spared that. But we in the East, where the winds are blowing from west to east in Western Canada, we had terrible smoke a lot of last summer. And you burn up these forests, they're putting more carbon into the atmosphere, and they're guaranteeing, you know, more forest fires. So that's bad feedback in itself.
Yeah. Well, but we have humans always have humans always lived in a stable climate, or have we faced an unstable climate before?
Well, you know, as we were discussing before, humans have been around for about 300,000 years. So they have been around through glaciations and then warmer periods like the period that we're in now. And they have lived through tremendous climate upheaval. But, you know, when you think about, but they have not lived in a warmer climate. They've lived in a colder climate than we have now, but they have not lived in a warmer climate. And when you think about, you know, the difference between how our ancestors lived 100,000 years ago or 50,000 years ago and how we live now, it is that if things got dicey where you were, you picked up and left. Now, you can't move, you know, San Francisco. You can't move New York. So we are in a very different situation. That's one point that's important to make. Another point that's important to make is that we now know from these ice cores in Greenland, interestingly enough, that the last 10,000 years have been unusually stable. Climate has been unusually stable. And it's no coincidence that what we consider to be, you know, civilization, cities, writing, organized religion, all of those, you know, metal work, all of those technologies or cultural practices arose in that period of unusual climate stability.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for a species that...
Farming, I should also add farming to that.
Right, right. I mean, for a species that for at least 300,000 years before existed, why only the last 10,000 years?
Yeah, you see the climate connection pretty clearly.
Well, something else that has developed in these last 10,000 years, or more likely last few hundred years, is capitalism, which you do have an essay about capitalism. C is for capitalism.
It's for capitalism.
How do you see capitalism and climate change?
Well, I think the great, you know, question before us, and it is a question, you know, this is a book, I want to say that Ages for Hope is a book also that, you know, that poses a lot of questions, doesn't necessarily have, that don't have easy answers. I think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, one of the, we're sort of taking this gamble, as it were, that we can deal with climate change using a capitalist system, making, you know, taking advantages, as it were, of the you know, innovative capacities of the capitalist system, which are clearly, you know, quite tremendous, because here we are, you know, watching AI roll out, et cetera. So, but it's not clear, you know, once again, it's just not clear that that's true, because there's a lot of money to be made digging fossil fuels out of the ground and burning them. So some people would say, well, if we use the levers of capitalism properly, you know, we will be able to deal with this. And some people would say that's actually not the case. We need to completely re-examine our economic system. And that's a big, you know, sort of a gamble that we're taking right now. And I think there's a lot to think about there, a tremendous amount to think about there. It's not clear to me that we can. You know, we've sort of been going down one road now for quite a long time, and we're not kind of getting very far, and so we may have to rethink things, but that's a lot easier said than done, obviously.
Do you think it's, I mean, this is a big question that revolutionaries take up, but do you think we could change the economic system?
Well, you know, now we're kind of getting a little bit above my pay grade here. You know, there are certainly a lot of people advocating, you know, what's come to be known as degrowth. But it is a sort of, if we want to call it an economic philosophy, I'm not sure exactly what you'd call it, that has not really been put into practice anywhere, although there's a lot of, you know, sort of theoretical work going on. And I think that has a lot to be said for it. I myself am, you know, very, you know, interested in that question, but I don't have an answer to it.
I regret to say I'm unfamiliar with these ideas of degrowth. Is it capital?
Oh, really? Yeah, no, it's a very important, you know, concept. I think it has gotten a lot more sort of press, maybe because we are so pro-growth here in the U.S., in Europe, and also in Japan. There's a book I have. It just came out in translation. I think it's called Slow Growth. It was a huge hit in Japan. It has not been a huge hit here in the U.S.
Yeah, degrowth. Is it degrowth with a capitalist, within the capitalist system, or is it a capitalist model? Or, of course, capitalism is being...
Yeah, and this it is really challenges a lot of the fundamentals of capitalism.
Yeah, because capitalism is so much about growth.
Exactly.
And then there's the other issue of developing countries and their stages of developing. And you do have a chapter on this, leapfrogging. This is the idea of how can you get a developing nation to truly develop further, technologically speaking, access to energy, these kind of things, without using the traditional fossil fuel model, which is interesting because this whole leapfrogging effect is really about, is the world, is the international community, are the richer nations willing to help other countries develop and provide the funding?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, any sort of path through, you know, avoiding, you know, sort of the absolute worst of climate change does require some kind of acknowledgement from, you know, developed countries that, you know, we've really caused the problem and we have a pretty big obligation to developing countries. And, you know, those acknowledgements have in a sort of formal setting within, you know, at these international climate conferences, there's been lip service paid to that. But I think developing countries would say the developed countries have never come through on their commitments of money and what's called technology transfer. And, you know, that happens at our peril, because obviously, you know, a very good example is India, a country that is very rapidly developing, and its carbon emissions are very rapidly increasing, and it would be a lot more efficient and cheaper in the long run, you know, for a country like the U.S. to be giving a lot of aid to India to try to direct development in a more sort of clean energy sort of way. That takes a lot of capital up front that developing countries often don't have. So this is a huge issue, and it's not going away, I can assure you.
And the idea here is if the rest of the world goes through the same development process that the United States, that Western Europe, that China went through, and sort of went through an industrial moment and all of these things, it would have a devastating impact for the amount of carbon dioxide, never mind other environmental impacts that would have on the world. We couldn't sustain that.
That sort of is, unfortunately, you know, when you run the numbers, that's the conclusion that you come to. But, you know, once again, one of the interesting things about watching the present moment is that we just get, you know, go on as before, and these things happen. There's sort of, you know, that sense that there's really, you know, no one in charge of this show. Everything is just sort of happening, everything everywhere all at once, just sort of happening, even though, you know, on some level, many, many, many very smart people have laid out what the consequences of this will be.
And of course, you can't blame those nations for wanting to develop. They have their own pressures and wishes and desires and dreams. And so the whole idea is, will the developed world, the richer nations, then, and this would be different. This would be different, not entirely different. I guess you could say the Marshall Plan with Japan and Germany during World War II. We certainly helped develop, redevelop Japan and Germany. But that's kind of the idea. Are the richer nations willing to put in to develop these other nations so they don't have to go through this sort of industrial moment?
Yeah, and I mean, one hopeful point that I will make here is, you know, one of the under the Inflation Reduction Act, which was passed in 2022, which was sort of our first piece of climate legislation here in this country, which is, there's also a chapter, I is for Inflation Reduction Act. Yep. There's a lot of money to try to develop new technologies, less carbon intensive technologies, carbon free technologies. And, you know, the hope is, as you bring down the cost of those, as you develop them, the cost comes down, you know, the sort of famous, you know, cost curve, reduction curve. Those technologies will become easier and easier for developing countries to adopt, because they'll just be so much cheaper. So, you know, there's the sort of directed direction of money and resources towards making this happen. And then there's also, you know, the possibility that if these things just become so much more attractive, that they will be sort of adopted in a even if the developed world, you know, doesn't get its act together.
Elizabeth Kolbert, you won the Pulitzer Prize for your book, The Sixth Extinction. This had a major impact. Had a major impact on me. I certainly see ourselves living through another moment of a great extinction. Since that book has come out, what has happened since? Are we just continuing on the same path towards the level of species that are going extinct?
Well, it's funny that you should ask that. There's putting out a 10th anniversary edition of the book. It's 10 years since the book came out, almost exactly. And I added a new chapter on that, on what we're seeing happening to insects, which were a group that, you know, people thought were sort of potentially more resistant to extinction because they're, you know, so numerous and have such high reproductive rates. But we're now seeing, you know, crashes in some insect populations. So I would say, unfortunately, the answer is yes. You know, things are proceeding apace, very much, very much, unfortunately, according to what I laid out in that book.
It's alarming what's happening to insects. I mean, I can, you know, anecdotally, I remember I was born in the 1970s. I remember as a kid, every time we get in the car and go drive somewhere, you'd end up having a few bugs that were smashed on the windshield. I'm hardly ever in a car anymore, but I hardly ever see that anymore.
Yeah, there's the people call that the windshield effect. And, you know, it's hard to document because, you know, people didn't go out and sort of count the number of smush bugs on their windshield so that we could compare. But it's definitely something that many, many people have noticed, including entomologists who, and I do actually know some entomologists who were trying to think of ways to actually recover some of the data, you know, from old windshield, you know, crashes. But I'm not sure anyone has been able to do that yet.
Oh, and of course, probably the difficulty there is many of us just instinctively, I think, dislike insects.
Yes, I think that's a terrible problem. And I think we need a much more appreciative relationship to insects, because without insects, the world, collapses very fast.
It does collapse. It is vital to the workings of the world, to the workings of the soil even.
Absolutely.
Elizabeth Colbert has been our guest. Again, Elizabeth Colbert is a award-winning journalist, author of a number of books. She has joined us to talk about her latest. It's called H is for Hope, Climate Change from A to Z. Elizabeth Colbert, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
That does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kristen Thomas is the engineer. Special thanks to the KPFA social media team. You can find archives of our program online. Just go to kpfa.org and look for Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich, and I thank you for listening.
We have been listening to an episode of Letters and Politics. Mitch Jezrich interviewed Elizabeth Colbert, the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, and the Sixth Extinction. This is Tuesday Cafe. I'm Sean Canaan. And coming up next week, I hope you come back and listen to us next week, because we're going to talk about healthcare on Tuesday Cafe at 10 o'clock on Tuesday. We'll hear from a healthcare navigator about how you can get coverage, healthcare coverage. We'll also talk with an advocate for a proposed Florida constitutional amendment that would expand Medicaid. So if you're interested in healthcare, if you have any questions for our guests, please tune in next Tuesday at 10:06 on WMNF's Tuesday Cafe. We will talk all about healthcare next Tuesday. And I'm certain in the coming weeks, we'll continue this conversation about the worsening climate crisis, and especially want to focus on what's happening on the Great Barrier Reef this summer in Australia. It's absolutely mind-boggling how much damage is happening to the corals this summer in the Great Barrier Reef because of the heat that humans have added to the atmosphere and to the oceans. So that's a future show. During this time slot tomorrow, Shelley will host an Earth Month episode of Midpoint. At 10 o'clock tomorrow, she'll be talking about the hazardous PFAS forever chemicals in our drinking water. We're going to hear NPR News headlines at 10:01. And then at 10:06, a great show, Wavemakers, with the award-winning Janet and Tom Scherberger. Their Wavemakers today are some of the students and teachers involved in an ambitious journalism project created with Poynter that examines the proposed redevelopment of the historic gas plant district in St. Petersburg. The students are from Lakewood High School, and they're a joy to talk with, and you will really enjoy speaking with them and hearing from them on Wavemakers coming up in about 5 minutes. And then at noon is Wide Awake America with Nadine Smith. This has been Tuesday Cafe, coming to you from the studios of WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Thanks so much for listening to WMNF's Tuesday Cafe.
From Wednesday Traffic Jam on WMNF, the Dolly Rods bring you high-energy bubblegum punk fun. Known nationally and internationally, this is an excellent opportunity to see what venues around the country have known for years. Pure punk joy at WMNF's Tropical Heatwave May 4th at the Cuban Club. For ticket information, go to tropicalheatwave.org.
WMNF's Eclectic Community Music Festival Tropical Heat Wave 2024 is taking place on May 4th in Ybor City. We are full up on food vendors and are now seeking arts and crafts vendors to offer a variety of items for attendees. Tropical Heat Wave will be held at the Cuban Club located on the corner of Republica de Cuba and Palm Avenue in Ybor City. For more information and vendor fees, please email WMNF at WMNF.org or call during business hours at 813-238-8001. Go to TropicalHeatWave.org for lineup, tickets, and more. Thanks.
TropicalHeatWave.org to get your WMNF Tropical Heatwave tickets Saturday, May 4th, 2024. See you there. This has been Tuesday Cafe on WMNF Tampa. Stay tuned for Wavemakers after NPR.